Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network since 2009. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky Tunes.
Hello, welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm your host, Darren Bresnitz. On today's episode, we welcome restaurant royalty, Sophie McNally, who's the founder and CEO of Kitchenette. We talk about growing up in the New York restaurant scene, her eventual move to the West Coast, and the founding and launch and incredible mission behind her company, Kitchenette. Then it's a dive deep into the archives from the garageful duo out of Virginia, now living in Brooklyn, known as the Winstons. They talk about their love for their blues, the raw energy of their live show, and their dynamic juxtaposition of devotion and depravity. It's a great, great, great performance. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on Heritage Radio Network.
Thank you.
Heaven's full of mules. Heaven's full of mules. Heaven's full of mules. Heaven's full of mules.
Sophie, welcome to Snacky Tunes. Appreciate you taking the time to sit down and chat. I know you're running a business, you got kids, you know, the holiday season's knocking at the door. So
yeah,
appreciate you making the time.
Of course. And thank you so much for having me. I'm a fan of the pod.
Oh, well, thank you so much. So listen, it is safe to say that few people have grown up in restaurants as much as you have. And not just restaurants, but like restaurant culture, and in no greater city than New York. How did growing up in that world affect your outlook on the world?
You know, it's funny. Yes, I grew up, both my parents were in the restaurant business in New York. They were both very hardworking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whatever your childhood is sort of becomes the norm. So it's always a funny question to answer. And I do remember someone asking me this question recently in a slightly different way, which was sort of like, well, weren't you just like a crazy kid that was like allowed to get whatever they wanted because your parents had these restaurants? And it was sort of the opposite. I think the effect it had on me was, and my siblings as well, though I wouldn't speak for them, is that I end up identifying more with the person serving you than the person sitting, you know, in the booth or at the table, asking for something, just because those were the people my parents spent, you know, their whole days with. So I think it gave me a sense of appreciation for, you know, everyone working a service job.
So you're not Eloise running amok in the plaza.
No. Opposite. No. And my parents would have been horrified. Would not have let that happen.
Of course. You're representing the family.
Yeah, exactly.
So being around not just, I would say, the food of it all and the show of it all, but being, you know, immersed in the hospitality, which is really, I think, why some of the restaurants that your family's a part of have stayed in business for so long. What did you learn about hospitality and service, especially since you related to those people more than maybe the customers at that age?
Sure. I think one of my biggest takeaways is the importance of clear communication and the importance of just things that, you know, in hindsight seem obvious. It's a lot of small gestures, making eye contact right away when someone walks in the door, never prioritizing the phone or screen when there's a real customer in front of you, but using those things, you know, in the ways that makes the most sense for the customer. You know, listening and being reasonable and trying to accommodate, and also recognizing, you know, rewarding or cultivating regulars. I think as much as a lot of, you know, well-known restaurants get publicity for the occasional celebrity, their success is really due to the people whose names are not household names and who come three or four times a week and who need to be treated like celebrities because they're the ones, you know, making your business.
Yeah, that neighborhood restaurant, regular repeat business is the actual secret to longevity. It's not,
correct.
You can't sustain heat. You can't sustain being a hotspot forever.
Exactly. And you never want to be too hot because people move on.
Yeah. You want to be the right level of popular where you're in vogue and then maybe you're a little less in vogue and then your back is a thing. It's just, it's like this ebb and flow, but the beating heartbeat of the restaurant is always the people who are coming in for lunch at 2 p.m. on a Tuesday.
Yeah, exactly.
So speaking of that, because what we're really getting at is the business side of the restaurant industry. And it's, you know, been more focused on now, I think, than ever about the slim margins and how to balance everything and pay and, you know, running a P&L and making sure that you make payroll and things like that. And you got into it pretty deep by serving as the interim CEO at your father's restaurant group. Mm-hmm. Was that a crash course? Did you know the business before, or was that when you really learned the business? And why is it so important to understand the business of working within the food world?
Yeah, I mean, so to answer the first part of the question, I had worked with my dad for a long time prior to serving as CEO. And so it was not new. I would say some of the issues that I dealt with were, you know, were things that I had always kind of taken the lead on because they were areas that my dad did not enjoy working in and just became more relevant when he was temporarily out of the picture for a few months. Sure. And so that was not, yes, it took sort of stepping up and a new level of focus, but it was not brand new. And I learned a lot, but there wasn't a humongous learning curve on the job, thankfully. And then what was the second part of that question?
Second part of just really understanding the world of business when it comes to working within food, either in a restaurant or a CPG business, or just, you know, what that really means to run the business of food.
Yeah. I mean, I would go back, and I don't even know if this is specific to food, but I would go back to the communication piece. I think that, you know, to our point earlier, being explicit about things in hospitality that might seem obvious, and sometimes that requires a ton of repetition about what service means to you and what your protocols are. You know, turnover in the hospitality industry traditionally has been high, so there are always new people, so that, you know, creates an opportunity for misinterpretation. And similarly, you know, communication around numbers and what you can afford to spend on different ingredients or labor, and figure and communicating about that, and not making assumptions that anything is a given. So I think making sure that you're talking to the bussers about giving, you know, guests the right of way when they're walking down, you know, in the restaurant, and talking to chefs about what your, you know, goals are for food costs are equally important.
Yeah. I mean, just really understanding like what it means to fit within the community is so important when you're running a restaurant, and understanding that people, especially in New York, are, you know, everyone has their apartment, but New York is really, it's an extended part of their living space as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, speaking of community, I know that beyond the restaurant world and the work you did with your family, you also got involved in the nonprofit space, especially when focusing on kids and food and nutrition and things like that. What got you into that world? What made you start looking at supporting the younger community of New York City?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so I was involved in Edible Schoolyard. I was their first employee in New York, and then continued to stay involved after leaving the organization formally, or as an employee. And I think from a young age, and maybe this is sort of subconsciously having been steeped in the world of food, although neither of my parents were chefs, so they weren't, you know, their focus was much more the business, the space, the hospitality, and yes, of course, the food, but they were not in the kitchen. I think I probably took an outsized interest in the food itself and sort of the health piece of it. And, you know, did my own reading and understanding from a pretty early age about, you know, what food systems look like in this country, what food access looks like, how big of an impact it can have on your long-term health. And I've always been interested in sort of how that connects to traditions around food and eating, and, you know, community is a big piece of that. So like eating dinner together around the table is really important and an indicator of long-term health for a lot of people. And I had known for a long time about Edible Schoolyard in Berkeley and had been really fascinated by it, and just Alice Waters and everything, you know, her whole ethos around food. And so when I learned that they were trying to open in New York, I just sort of jumped at the opportunity to get involved.
And did you find a welcoming reception to this type of support and this type of action of supporting parents and kids and getting them to think about what they put in their bodies and nutrition and helping people eat and get a better meal possibly than processed foods into their daily livelihood?
Yeah. I mean, in my experience, it's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, you have to have buy-in from the community, whether that's the kids themselves, the school, the parents. That's a really critical piece of it that I think often gets overlooked. But yes, the reception was very positive. I mean, we were a nonprofit bringing a big, you know, beautiful garden to what had been a parking lot. And it was incredible to sort of see that transformation. There were not many opponents.
No. I think if you're just supporting and not 100% preaching, I think, you know, New Yorkers as a whole can be very receptive to change if it's coming from the right spot.
Yeah.
Now listen, born and bred in New York, in the restaurant world, nonprofit, but you moved. You moved to the West Coast, which is also where I'm located as well. What eventually got you out of New York City? You know, if anyone I thought would be in there forever, I would say it'd be you, but now it's just a place you visit.
It is. I surprised myself with that. and I would probably blame it on my husband. I mean, I would. When we were getting married or planning to, he had moved to LA and I was doing the bi-coastal thing for a few years.
Sure.
And then when it finally came down to figuring out where we were going to settle, for a handful of reasons, LA just sort of won, or the West Coast did. At the time it was LA. I was leaving for good from my family business, my dad's restaurants. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of at a crossroads career-wise and had the flexibility to move because of that. And we had sort of, you know, developed a community in LA and a lot of friends had moved there, as I'm sure you've seen in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. There's been a big movement from New York to LA. And I think we both felt like it had been this one industry town that was becoming a lot more interesting. And New York felt like it was becoming more and more gentrified and less, and we were in Manhattan. I think there's a very different vibe in Brooklyn where I have friends who are raising family.
I will say I went back to Williamsburg, and of all the places I visited, that felt the most different versus like the East Village and things like that.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah.
The weather, it's got the weather going and a vibrant food scene. I mean, back to sort of like the interest in where food comes from, the farmers markets were like a really big pull for me.
Yeah. You can just, I mean, it feels so much like Paris and France where just like every little area has its own farmers market. You don't just have to go to, you know, one of the more centralized places and fight the crowds every 3 days.
Exactly.
Let's take a quick little break. And when I come back, I want to talk about Kitchenette, your company.
Great.
I want to talk about how you've merged all your worlds together to help sort of find the foundation for this and how actually you did look to other countries like Paris, like France, to get away from the stigma of frozen food that sometimes you can find in America. We have a song from the archives and then a musical break here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
See. with me. When you're off alone, abide with me.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We're here with Sophie McNally, the founder and CEO of Kitchenette. And before the break, we were chatting about you leaving New York for the West Coast. And not only that, you said that you had left the family business of the restaurant world. When did you start thinking about what you wanted to do next? And was it always going to be food? Was it always going to be something within the culinary landscape? How did you identify what was missing from what you thought was, you know, again, a pretty saturated food market?
Yeah. So when we moved, I think I always gravitated towards food. So mm-hmm. I probably entertained other things, but that was always, you know, my focus. When I settled into LA and finally became full-time as opposed to bicoastal, I had just had a baby, and then COVID hit on her first birthday. And so everything kind of quieted down for a minute. I was just sort of cooking three meals a day, trying to figure out when this was going to come to an end, and then hit a wall, and didn't want to cook anymore and really missed working, and started using the freezer in a way that I just never had before. I don't think I used my freezer for anything in New York. But when you're trying to feed a family and they have to eat three times a day, and you want to have a meal together at 5:30, it's just like the math doesn't work for a lot of people. You have to start cooking at 4, and that's the middle of the workday in my book. And so I started batch cooking, you know, things that froze really well, so like meatballs, casseroles, etc. And it was really like a game changer for me. And then when I got even lazier and looked around for sources to buy this stuff, I couldn't find anything. And I was really surprised. And it made me think a lot about a company that I've always admired in France called Picard. And Picard is a huge company that I think is like vertically integrated at this point. But they have brick and mortar stores all over France. So like in every neighborhood, there's a Picard. And they're these really small footprint shops. They're just full of freezers. And, you know, even Parisians will buy these frozen hors d'oeuvres and serve them at their dinner party. So that alone sort of made me feel like the U.S. could do better and could have something that wasn't sad. There are a handful of frozen products that are decent, but nothing that really felt like family dinner for me or a shared dinner. Like you can get a good burrito, but I don't want to sit around the table and each unwrap your own burrito for dinner. Like that's super depressing. And so I did some research. I sort of looked at Other, even in the UK, there are a lot more options for like family style frozen meals. And just started doing some R&D. I found a chef to work with. I'm very much a home cook and not professional. So,
I needed someone who had a specific type of cooking too.
Yes, exactly. Put a business plan together. And, in the meantime, we had actually left LA. We'd moved to Santa Barbara. Mm. It was supposed to be temporary. And then like a lot of people, we just ended up staying. Yeah, and that was sort of my inspiration, was my personal experience and starting to use the freezer and talking to other people, especially, you know, parents, because that's sort of where I am in life, about how they fed their families. And everyone seems to struggle with it at least a couple times a week. I mean, I think that the aspiration is always to cook fresh. And if you can pick, you know, vegetables from your garden and sure. have amazing proteins 7 nights a week, great. But I found that was not the case for most people. And so on the nights when, you know, you might otherwise resort to ordering out, I felt like this was a much better alternative. And then looking at sort of the other alternative, which is meal kits, it again missed that communal component for me that I think is really important. And also involved a lot of waste, both in terms of the amount of packaging mm-hmm. and shipping that goes into those things, but also food waste. And that's something that, especially during COVID, I just started becoming, and I think since having kids, much more conscious of, was, you know, the extent to which our food system contributes to the climate issues. And food waste is a big piece of that. I think about 40% of food in the U.S. goes to waste. Wow. And a lot of that is food that ends up in landfills, which creates greenhouse gases that are much more potent than CO2. So mm-hmm. it also felt preventable. And so the secondary sort of problem that frozen food solved for me was not having to micromanage what was in my fridge all week long. And try to avoid throwing anything out.
Mm. So you have this idea, this new concept of presenting easy meals for working families, which as a father who cooks for the family, I completely can relate to. But then you also have this background of like the restaurant world and hospitality and business and nutrition and, you know, being a mom yourself. And it's great to have all these things swirling around your head, but how do you take all those things and turn it into the reality of kitchenette?
I really started from a place of like what I wanted, knowing everything that I know and knowing how careful I am about sourcing for my own family and for myself, while also making it, you know, somewhat affordable. Although having said that, like our price point is not comparable to what you'll find in the freezer section of grocery store. It's much more of an alternative to, say, like meal kits or takeout. And I think it's worth paying for real food. So the sourcing and sort of the nutritional component was really important to me. But then, you know, having come maybe from the restaurants, I think first you have to focus on flavor. I mean, it has to be delicious. It has to be enjoyable. Yeah. You have to create a positive experience, and then you have to make it the best version of that possible from, you know, a nutritional point of view.
Yeah. I mean, it can't just be, and I think this is where sometimes the stigma can come from in America. It's either like an insane amount of food. And I'm thinking of like the Hunger Man double XL. It's like a salt bomb or a sugar bomb, or it's just mush. There's like no texture. And so having that idea of pulling from other countries, as you mentioned, like France, like the UK, where they think they've taken a different route in what frozen meals can be, that is a different way. I mean, that's like the first step, maybe shifting the perception and the stigma in America.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. And I think that there just haven't been, I've thought a lot about the sort of stigma piece in the US and why it's the case. I think that, you know, the association with TV dinners is still there. And those are obviously the opposite of like, you know, a communal, again, like shared dinner experience. It's solitary. You're sitting in front of the TV. It's sort of like everything you're not supposed to do when you're eating a meal, dinner in particular. Mm-hmm. And then I think the farm to table movement, which I am all for and believe in sort of the philosophy of, has really emphasized freshness and local, which is great for the most part, but I think it's been at the expense of, or sort of, yeah, at the expense of the opportunities when it comes to frozen. So I think go ahead.
No, I was going to say just on the farm to table and the freshness and all like that, especially living, you know, where you do and how that is such like an emphasis on the way people eat if they want to eat healthy. How do you develop your recipes? I mean, I can't imagine you developed one recipe. I know you talked about working with a chef and it was a smash hit. Like, did it take time to figure out what worked and what didn't work and how to balance all of your needs and what you wanted to say to put into the meals of Kitchenette?
Yes. I mean, it took quite a bit of time, especially for those early recipes, as we launched with 4 dishes. We had planned to launch with 5, but we weren't very happy. We were not happy with the 5th. And so we went with 4. And we've since introduced many new dishes and hope to continue introducing lots more. We've learned that our customers really want variety. So I think that means seasonality, but also just different cuisine, et cetera. The first 4 were really staples, and because it was sort of what we were coming out the gate with, I think there was a big emphasis, obviously, on making sure each was as close to perfect as possible. And it's an iterative process. You know, we listen for feedback very closely. So we've made lots of small changes to specific dishes and then introduced things based on what we're hearing from our customers.
I mean, it's great to have such a community, which is, again, those repeat customers that you talked about in a restaurant that are really this, you know, the steady heartbeat of any business, getting those people to return again and again. And offering them something different. I know that you partnered with Bettina, which is arguably probably the most popular pizza place in Santa Barbara. How did that partnership come about? Is that sort of what you're going to offer as well? These other revenue sources for restaurants that have meals that work within your system?
Yeah. So the Bettina partnership came about. And for those who don't know, Bettina is a amazing restaurant and pizzeria in Santa Barbara. And you should always book in advance. They take walk-ins, but we're sort of a last minute type of family. and so I could never get it together to remember to order, you know, a pizza to go 90 minutes in advance. It's sort of like I call when my kids are hungry. And once we started doing the frozen family dinners, I sort of thought like, it just seemed obvious. So I actually approached Rachel. Rachel and Brendan are the owners. And I just cold emailed her. It's a tiny community. So as soon as we met, we realized we, you know, had lots of people in common. But I just said, look, we have a blast freezer. We have the distribution. We have the marketing channels. We have a small customer base now. And you guys have excess demand. Like, this seems obvious. And she sort of took a leap of faith and said, yeah, we're interested in trying it. And so it's been about a month now and it's been great. They've been amazing to work with and, it's been very well received. The pizzas are delicious. The best, the local, sort of newsletter, like lifestyle newsletter here, recently reviewed it and he said it was the best frozen pizza he's ever had. And I would agree.
Yeah, it's phenomenal pizza. So the business up and running, you're in Wisconsin, Santa Barbara. What does the future of Kitchenette look like? What would you love to see?
I would love to see Kitchenette in every American household. That's obviously a ways away. You know, we also say, and this is sort of like a mission statement, but it's worth sharing that we, you know, want to make the freezer every household's greatest ally. I think that when you look at even like blogs about the aspirational freezer organization or like the pantries that are perfectly organized that I've heard people call mom porn or parent porn. I want people to think about their freezer that way. Like, I really, I believe that rethinking how you use that space can be, can have huge benefits and go a really long way. So I hope we help shift the culture around frozen food and people's perception of what it can be. And also just to continue to grow. And yes, I would love to do more restaurant partnerships. We're taking things very deliberately, slowly, because, you know, we don't want to get ahead of ourselves, and quality and consistency is really important. But yeah, we hope to continue to grow.
Amazing. Well, listen, congratulations on everything. If people want to follow along, or if they live in the area, they want to sign up for meals, where can they go? How can they get more information?
Sure. So we're, our website and social media is Get Kitchenette. The website is getkitchenette.com. And we sell directly through our website. We're also available at the Eddy, which is a great little grocer, new grocer in Santa Barbara. And that's it. We're only local at the moment, but also sign up for our newsletter if you want to know when we come to you.
Amazing. Well, thank you, Sophie, and shout out to Karen for setting this up. We have another song from the archives and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
Tell me what I want to hear. Tell me what I need to know. Tell me that you love me, dear, and you'll never, never let me go. 'Cause even if it isn't true, oh, I promise I'll be good to you. So tell me what I want to hear. Oh, yeah. Tell me what I need to know. I don't need to believe that look that's in your eyes. 'Cause you keep on telling me, darling, all those sweet, sweet lies. Baby, in your way, tell me what I wanna hear. Whoa, tell me what I need to know. Tell me that you love me, dear, and you'll never, never let me go. 'Cause even if it isn't true, oh, I promise I'll be good to you. So tell me what I wanna hear, oh yeah, tell me what I need to know. Tell me what I wanna hear. Tell me what I need to know. Tell me that you love me, dear, and you'll never, never let me go. 'Cause even if it isn't true, oh, I promise I'll be good to you. So tell me what I wanna hear, oh yeah. Tell me what I need to know. Oh, tell me what I wanna hear, oh yeah. Tell me what I need to know.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. I'm here with Lou and Ben, who make up Winston's. Welcome, boys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Really good to have you
in studio.
Very glad to be here.
Yeah. So how did you make it to Brooklyn from Virginia?
By car, I-95 north.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you stop? Did you take any scenic routes?
Yeah, I think we stopped at Walt Whitman on the New Jersey Turnpike.
Yeah, it's my favorite.
Did you go direct? Some people will. I mean, it's not much of a road trip, but did you turn any of it into a road trip?
We have. We've done that corridor
a lot.
What's the secret?
Timing.
Go fast.
Not hit the beltway in D.C. around rush hour. That'll add 3 hours.
Okay, fair.
That's pretty practical. Moving up here, I used to have a Ford Ranger pickup, and I totally tortoiseshell. I looked like a snail. I pretty much had everything I owned and was bringing and just put, three tarps over it and totally Beverly Hillbilly styled it with duct tape and tarps and everything I owned under it and moved up here in a day and got here at, midnight. And
what brought you up here? Or what forced you out of Virginia?
I met a girl playing a show up here and decided I was going to move to New York
City. Classic story. Where's the girl?
She's at home right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, with her two stepcats.
Oh, okay. Is she with you?
Uh-huh.
Oh, amazing. That story doesn't... I mean, I feel like the New York story is you're met a girl, where's the girl? Doesn't matter.
Ben, how's your girl? What happened to her?
I have the same exact story.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you both met girls that... Was that the same show or was it different show?
Oh, okay. Yeah, not the same exactly.
No, we were playing with different people. We didn't know each other until we lived in Brooklyn.
Oh, okay.
But we were living in the same city in Virginia.
Yeah, we spent a long time.
Are you both from Virginia?
I was born and raised in Richmond.
Okay.
Yeah.
I grew up in New Hampshire and then lived in Virginia for 10 years.
So did the band form because you had similar partner stories, or how did you guys get together?
I think we were both kind of starting over in terms of music, having relocated here by ourselves independently.
Because you have two different backgrounds, right? Lou, you're into country and bluegrass, and Ben, you've got jazz horn?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's how I grew up. I learned how to play music playing tenor saxophone.
Okay.
So drums is still an indomitable task for me, but it came easy after doing those kind of chord changes and trying to solo over it. I was like, oh, I get to hit things now? Great.
I mean, you've pared it down to a snare, a brass, a tambo, and a kick drum.
Yeah, there's still metal involved.
There's some metal on board. And how were you convinced to put down the sax and pick up the stick?
Oh, it's easier to play with people. And that's kind of what happened with us. It was like, hey, you want to jam sometime? And then it worked really well and made us both happy, so.
Yeah, no one was begging for a sax player in a Brooklyn band?
No.
And then for for your background of country and bluegrass.
I grew up playing cello and guitar when I was little. And then picked up banjo as a teenager and then got paid for the first time to play music playing banjo, being a banjo sideman.
What was the gig?
It was a guy I knew in college who had a band asked me to join his buddy's band. Filling it out with a fiddle player and a banjo player.
Was it a Dave Matthews or Bella Fleck cover band?
No, it wasn't. It was pretty traditional, pretty old. There's a huge amount of, I mean, that's, we were in Charlottesville, which is kind of Appalachia adjacent, and everybody grew up playing, and all their daddies play, and all their granddaddies play, and there's so many unbelievable musicians around there. And there's, every corner bar has a Cracker Jack bluegrass band.
Got it. Do you remember the name of the band?
The first time I got paid $40 to play in Joe Mama's Pajamas one night at the Gravity Lounge. Wow. Yeah, it wasn't my band. I didn't name it. I didn't sing.
Gravity Lounge is now a CVS, in case you're curious.
I am. That's sad.
Yeah.
That's sad.
Common tale.
Yes, it is.
And how long did you play the banjo before you kind of swapped over to a guitar and started writing your own music?
I formed a band probably 2 or 3 years after that. And started writing songs and playing songs I'd written. Still playing banjo and doing kind of a heavier rock and roll, mountain rock and roll type thing. And then
what is mountain rock and roll?
It was something we made up because it was bluegrass with drums and electric guitars. Got tired of playing banjo. Just got really wasn't good enough to be nuts about it. Wasn't that super into the really technical stuff. Had always grown up playing guitar and was more comfortable with it. So after getting paid to play banjo for a while, I figured maybe I could just play guitar because do more with it.
What is the most surprising thing about playing banjo that an uninitiated person wouldn't know that makes it so difficult or hard to master?
It's just so much right hand. It's so much finger picking. I mean, you can play it a bunch of different ways, and a lot of people do really. There's like claw hammer and there's three finger style, and some people just strum it or play it like a guitar. I was really into Lester Flatt and doing the three finger style. And it just, I used to just literally sit on the couch with the TV remote in my left hand and just do rolls with my finger picks with my right hands for hours and hours and hours. It's just muscle memory.
Okay.
Building that up.
Can we hear a song?
Yeah.
What are you guys going to play for us first?
This is called Enough. It's the B-side of a 7-inch we put out February 17th on Warhen Records and Grand Jury Records.
Great. Here live on Snacky Tunes. I want to read a question that you guys sent over to me before the show. Salad, what's the deal?
What's the deal with salad?
What's the deal with salad?
I put everything in it these days.
I know.
I think it's just they everybody's trying to get rid of bread, so they're just making big sandwiches and calling them salads.
They're just like, this is a salad. You're like, it's a pound and a half. I think you've missed the point.
Yeah. It's as long as you leave the bread out.
It's fine. Salad. It's just salad. So you work over at Greenpoint Fish and Lobster.
I do. I wait tables over there. You since wait. They open.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
Those boys are great. We've worked with them in the past.
It's a great institution.
What is a fan favorite over there of yours? What is probably one of the more underrepresented menu items?
The fish sandwich with French fries.
It's the best.
It's killer.
It's the best. I feel like it's one of the best deals in Greenpoint.
Yeah, it's certainly not the thriftiest thing happening.
Other than a dollar Jello shot at Capri Lounge.
Fine. Ooh. That yeah, okay. That, I mean, I think we're in two different worlds at that point. Yes, nothing could be. Actually, my friend had a surprise birthday party there, and just cleared out the Jello shots, and it was like $22, and everyone was just done.
They make for the best mornings.
Yeah, I mean, I can't believe like
you drink them in the morning. Is that what you mean?
Like you put it in your pocket. The next yeah, like just, sure. It's like a to go. It's the only to go type of cup you can get.
Bathtub of Jello shots.
Bathtub of Jello shots. I mean, I wonder where in the hierarchy of Capri are you making Jello shots? Is it at the beginning? Like is that, or you work your way up because it's such a backbone, iconic staple there? It's like no. Only good. Samantha makes the Jello shots.
I mean, sure. I think it'd be a lauded position as the 6 p.m. slurp. Whoever gets to taste test that jungle juice.
I don't know. I watched most of Crocodile Dundee in there the other night with commercial breaks.
I mean, the place, if you haven't been, it's probably one of the, like, the last havens of best dive bars in Greenpoint.
That's a good one. There's a couple. Conio's is mine, if you've ever been there.
Where is that?
It's right around the corner from me.
It's under Norman. His house. It's in the basement.
It's pretty much under my house.
It's the sign outside my bedroom door. Yes. It's called Conio's.
It's terrific. Yeah. If you go there, say hey to Barbara for me. Or Lou said hello. I'll tell her myself.
You guys have a recording project in the financial district.
Yeah, we were there all day yesterday.
What's the setup and why the financial district?
A friend of ours who's a producer had been had taken an interest in what we were up to next, and we said let's work with you in his room. It's called Full Tone Studios, and it's on Fulton.
No, you didn't have to say that. No, we got it. But for the people not in New York, yeah.
It's fun down there. It's interesting. I got into the elevator yesterday at noon with an 18-pack of Miller Lite, and all the construction dudes were in there. And I was like, I couldn't find the door to the basement. And they were like, oh, come to the elevator. I walk in, the door closes, and they push 10. And then they all just cracked up at my expense. You know, it's worth it.
And is it one of those things like before 5, you can't really do anything, but after 5, it's just kind of no noise problems, no nothing?
It's in the basement. I don't think there's much down there except for... they have a couple of mouser cats in the hallways.
Yeah.
But there's not much going on otherwise. But it's just a big room. We're a two-piece, so we like to use all the air, try not to, like, segment too much. We don't need a lot of space, but we were there for 10 hours yesterday tracking for...
What are you guys working on?
We just always keep working. So we just put out a 7-inch. We're thinking our next project is probably going to be a full-length. So we just did a day in the studio, and we don't know what we have yet, but we'll see, and just keep every couple of weeks we'll book some studio time.
And the 7-inch came out, and you mentioned it before, in Grand Jury and Warhen Records, so how did you hook up with them, and why a 7-inch?
We had two songs that we really liked, so we put it on a piece of wax. Warhen is Luke's buddy from Charlottesville for a long time. Real good dude. He used to do production at the Jefferson, which is like the biggest...
it's a big theater down there.
Yeah, it's nice. There.
And he has this boutique 7-inch label. So we had been touring. We did two southern trips last summer touring, and we were coming back from one and booked some studio time at a small studio where I used to live that a buddy of mine runs. And so we just went in and recorded for 2 days before we came back to New York. And then started sending those tracks around. He wanted to put it on a 7-inch. And then we and Grand Jury wanted to put it out digitally.
Yeah, Craig and Robbie saw us open for Esme Patterson at Mercury Lounge. And we're like, hey. And we went on tour with her later that summer.
And so Texas, you're like, New Orleans, hey, again.
Yeah.
Yeah, we said, hey, back.
It was super convenient. The run started in Dallas.
Oh, okay.
At some point, someone said, yo, or sup.
Sup. And then they just, like, slid a piece of paper with a shot of two shots of bourbon next to it, and that's how it goes.
Yeah.
That's how it goes.
Yeah. Can we hear another song?
Plied.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you going to play for us?
It's a song called Heaven's Full of Mules. We haven't put it out yet, but we've tracked it and probably will put it out.
Perfect.
Not too long.
Okay, here live on Snacky Tunes. Winston's are quoted as saying, wearing the band t-shirt to the band is a new power move. Explain.
Yeah.
That's my friend Najla. She's a gem.
We've had a couple of those. We like it.
Yeah.
It's undoing years of the opposite.
Right. No, we got a buddy, Fernando, who came to our release show, and by the time we started, with the first time those t-shirts were available, he had purchased one, put it on, and was in the front row.
Better story about Fernando, not to try and one-up you, is that on New Year's Eve, Fernando proposed to his lady during our set. She said yes.
Congratulations, yeah. Fernando. Was he wearing the shirt?
But he was by himself at the... No, he didn't have the shirt yet. And he was by himself when he had the shirt, but I think they're still... I don't know.
I mean, January's not that... It's not that far away. It's a really... It's not that far.
No, not that far. No, I think all is well.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is the new power move. We're buying the brand new band t-shirt, putting it on, and going to the front row.
Just so they know that you're a fan. Not just because you're there, but you're there right. for them.
Yes.
Right. It does feel good.
Yeah.
It's undeniable.
It definitely feels good, especially if you're not the headliner. So they know that they came for
oh,
you.
Oh, yeah. Boy, like, do we love better. Not being the headliner.
We were headlining that night, though.
Oh, okay.
Unfortunately.
Apologies. Yeah. So just Fernando, the t-shirt.
We should have not headlined our own release show. That would have been the real power move.
That is a real power. Actually, that is a real power move.
Maximum humility.
I think you play second to last. So you're the peak.
That's cool. And then you have
someone else.
The after plus, party.
That's the after party.
Mm.
We've had that move before, haven't we? I don't know.
How many releases have you had?
Three.
As many as I can get.
Three?
Yeah.
Oh, in Clear Plastic Masks. Our first tape, we had an after party. It was Clear Plastic Masks.
Okay.
We were arguably the support for that.
For your own release party.
Okay.
Arguably.
That's fine. So now you're tracking, but any tours coming up, hitting the road?
We're going back down to Virginia at the end of this month. I'm playing some shows down there.
Yeah, we're going to go play our buddy Gold Connection's release at the Southern in Charlottesville.
Mm-hmm.
Going to play most of my stuff around
there. Doing a release on Fat Possum.
Yeah.
And we're going down there for that, and we're going to be in Jersey, right? And
yeah, Jersey. Philadelphia.
All
the dirty towns.
Yeah, Jersey, Philly.
Probably Harrisonburg again.
Harrisonburg, Virginia. Richmond, Virginia.
We played a wonderful open mic in Harrisonburg.
Were you booked in? Were you booked in for the open mic,
yeah.
or did you just stop by?
We were special guests.
We had a night off, but then we got paid and fed and
it was
drank.
It was.
I mean, maybe I don't understand the concept of open mic, but how did you get booked for an open mic?
It was open, but. You know, other random people.
No, somebody dropped out, right? And then we hopped on. We had a night off on the road. We had nothing better to do, and something fell in our lap. We took it. It was great.
I think it was the best show I've ever played.
Ever?
It's the best open mic you've ever played.
Harrisonburg, Virginia. Clementine's.
Yeah, best open mic.
No, it's Ruby's. It was downstairs.
Ruby's is downstairs.
And it's now a Duane Reade.
No! Don't tell me that.
Well, I want to get one last question in, or more of a statement before you guys take us out.
Mm-hmm.
Sent from the band, eggs. They're just not for breakfast anymore. Discuss.
I eat eggs for every meal.
Yeah.
And my cholesterol is happy.
I'll get a dozen eggs and I'll like hard boil half of them and just save them in the fridge for.
Just because?
Just a quick, healthy snack.
You put an egg on anything, man.
Right? You could. You could put an egg on anything,
you could put it on a salad.
Put it on a salad.
Ice cream.
You could call this egg by itself a salad.
Yeah, you could.
The classic trump card for you can put something on anything is ice cream. And vanilla ice cream with an egg on top, I think, with some salt, would be really good.
Wow.
Okay.
Egg ice cream. Breaking boundaries.
Well,
just you guys wait.
We're going to make sure you guys have time for one more song. Where can people find you, get the 7-inch, find out updates, catch you on tour, catch you at open mics?
Winston's band. Everything at .com, www.
Yeah, everything's Winston's band.
There's an S in there that people can't hear.
Winston's band. .com / Winston's band.
Perfect.
And no article. Never, ever an article. No the.
Or That's just inappropriate.
Yeah, it's inappropriate.
Yeah, well, I mean, it would
or
counteract.
These. We could be these Winstons.
These Winstons. It would counteract all rooms of grammar and leave one of you out.
From now on, we shall be known as these Winstons.
That's pretty good.
Band.com.
What are you going to take us out with?
This is a song. Can you mildly curse on this?
Yes.
It's called Goddamn Goodbye.
You're fine. Well, thanks to everyone for being on the show today. We'll be back next week with another episode of Snacky Tunes. Take us out.
Thanks so much, listeners. Yeah, there's a new one. We haven't put it out anywhere yet, I don't think. But we will. We will. We're putting it out right now. Out of the universe.
know you saw me standing at the station before my train coming, and you pretended I was some other person. Kept walking home and kept it here.
Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Subscribe.